Hi there, I'm Jess Milton, producer of The Vinyl Cafe, and you're listening to The Medley with Blake Crash Priddle.
Hello, and welcome to The Medley. I'm Blake Crash Priddle, and this week I am absolutely honored to have Jess Milton, the former producer of the best Canadian radio show of all time, The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. She continues to keep Stuart McLean's legacy alive, and she's going to tell us some behind-the-scenes stories of working on this awesome show, as well as some fond and funny memories that she had with the late Stuart McLean. Tell us about your career before you were the producer of The Vinyl Cafe.
Well, I was young when I started working. So I guess right before I worked on The Vinyl Cafe as an associate producer, but I didn't have a long career before The Vinyl Cafe. I worked, I paid most of my way through university. So I did work through university. I worked at a sports television station as an assistant production assistant, which is like an assistant's assistant. So you can see everybody starts somewhere. And I also worked as an intern on the National, and I worked in archives at CBC Television. And then I went to a university for broadcast journalism, and right out of school, I got hired as a production assistant on the Vinyl Cafe. So I kept my job at the Score, the sports television station. And at that point, I was a production assistant there, working sort of 6 p.m. till about 4 a.m. And then I'd head over to CBC and work there sort of 10 till 6. So it was busy, but lots of good experience.
Did you listen to the Vinyl Cafe before getting the job?
Not religiously. Like, I didn't. I would have been a teenager when the show started. My parents listened to CBC Radio, but they weren't people who always and only listened to CBC Radio. So I certainly had heard it and was aware of Stuart. I had Stuart as a teacher, and so I knew his work, and I had listened to the show and liked it. I liked the tone of it, but I wasn't a weekly listener. I didn't listen with any regularity.
I have to say that back in high school in 2011, I had the immense pleasure of interviewing Mr. Stuart McLean before one of his shows in Sudbury, and that was one of the highlights of my journalism career. And I imagine that it was a phenomenal experience working on the Vinyl Cafe with him.
I remember that interview that you did with him. It was a phenomenal experience. We worked really well together. And it was nice to be able to work with someone whose values and kind of impression of the world so closely aligned with my own. He was lovely, as you experienced.
What was your favorite memory of working with Stuart McLean? Because I know that he's done shows all over the country, and I think even in the United States. What was your favorite adventure?
I think probably my favorite was one of my last memories. And so maybe this is just recency bias, but there was a show that we did. You know, we did shows in small towns and in big cities, and we did shows in little tiny theaters, you know, the smallest being, I remember one time in Tofino, I think it was 49 people at the show. But near the end of the show, we started doing bigger and bigger shows, including in some arena shows, the kind of big shows that, you know, maybe not Taylor Swift, but like, you know, that like Tragically Hip or someone would do, these big hockey arenas that we would turn into a theater. And we did that strictly for efficiency's sake. It's not where we preferred to play. We preferred soft seat theaters. But there were some occasions, especially at the Christmas tour, there are only so many days a year where you can do a Christmas tour. So you can't really do a Christmas tour in like October, right? And so we had to start maximizing the theaters and going playing larger and larger theaters. And Halifax, Nova Scotia, always had been trying to get us to do a show there. And there just wasn't time, because to get down east and then to get back out west to go across the country for the Christmas tour was difficult. And someone along the line, maybe our promoter, Don Jones, or maybe it was me, someone said, well, what if we, the theater that we usually played there was the Rebecca Cohen Auditorium, which we loved, but we thought, well, we were not going to have time to do two or three shows. What if we did an arena show with 5 or 6,000 instead of 1 or 2,000? And that's what we did. We turned the hockey arena in Halifax into a huge, we did an arena show, turned it from a rink into a big theater with 5,000 people. And it was a big undertaking in the middle of a Christmas tour. The set was different, and Everyone was telling me that it was a bad idea. Everyone, they were trying to get me to put screens up to project Stuart's image, and people would be too far away. And it just felt wrong for our show. Our show was very intimate and very stripped down. And so I was nervous going into it because I had rejected all of that really good advice. And I wasn't sure if I was going to be right or if I was going to be wrong. And then to complicate things, Stuart was diagnosed with cancer just before that show, like a couple of days before the show. We had not announced it yet. We told our crew and our musicians that were traveling with us and our small little team, but we were going to announce it after that show in Halifax. And so all of us, we all knew something that the audience didn't. And there were 5 or 6,000 people gathered in this arena. And Stuart walked out on stage, and it was electric. Like the venue was fantastic. The people were so excited to be there, and it felt different in a really lovely way. And he looked over at me, and the smile on his face was, I will remember it for the rest of my life. It was a really special moment, and it was the second last show we ever did together. So that moment was great. But also at the end of the show, in the finale, the audience had such a good time that they all started taking their phones out and using them like the way we used to when I was a kid, like youth or teenager, use lighters in a venue. And they were all, you had 5,000 people singing along with their phones, lighting up the arena. And it will always be one of my favorite memories.
You also recorded an episode of the show on, I believe it was the Canadian Via Rail train in the Dome Car. Was that a challenging show to record with the sounds of the train and everything?
It was a real challenge in a whole bunch of ways. So I embraced the sound, like from a production standpoint, I embraced the crazy sounds of the train. But there's some gimmicks, or not some gimmicks, some tricks of the trade that you do. So before everyone gathered, I recorded a couple hours of just the sounds without anyone there, so that because the thing about sound is, if it's a constant murmur, or in this case, a clickety clack of the track, your ears get used to that. So it's not distracting for the audience. In fact, it gives it a strong sense of place, which is something I always tried to do with our show, was inject it with a personality at the place that we were trying to record in. And so it gave it that in a very effective way. But it's annoying as an audience member when it appears, disappears, appears, disappears. And so you just lay down a track, like when you're recording, you lay down another track with just the ambient sound. And it gives it a constant, it covers up all that in out thing, which is kind of constant. And so that's one way we got around that. The challenge in that case was more, so less so an audio challenge and more so a logistical challenge, like bringing all the equipment on the train. They're so small, there's no room, trying to fit everybody into that space. We had a musician with us, our dear friend Reed Jameson, so making sure the sound worked for him and worked for the audience. And we were all packed in there like sardines, which was I don't know, I liked it. Like, it was kind of fun and it was so different, but it was certainly not, there were people sitting on the floor and people sort of standing up and that kind of thing. I'm not sure how much they liked it, although they all said that they did. So yeah, it was a challenge for sure, but I love those challenges. It's kind of like a puzzle, and as a producer, that's the sort of thing that keeps me engaged.
The Vinyl Cafe was famous for the Dave and Morley stories, which we'll talk a little bit more about shortly. But what also made the show special was the fact that it introduced artists that were up and coming and helped them to get publicity. How important was it to you and Stuart that up and coming artists, got the publicity to succeed?
Hugely important. So Stuart used to say that he wanted to sh shine the light on undiscovered musicians. He wanted to share his spotlight, basically. So people had, people would listen to our show, and he wanted to share that spotlight with others. And I think it's a really lovely thing. But also, the light that they had, their own light, right? So it started off with us wanting to be generous to people and musicians who were just starting out. But really, over time, we realized we benefited just as much as them. They brought so much to our show, and we were really grateful for that. So I was speaking with my friend Danny Michelle recently, Danny has toured with us for years. We figured out the other day that we'd done about 100 shows together, and I interviewed him for my podcast, backstage at the Vinyl Cafe recently, and we talked about this very issue. And he said, it was so nice how you did that. And I said, Danny, it wasn't like we benefited as much, if not more so than the musicians. It was a win-win. And then he said, no, it was a win-win-win because the show, Stuart benefited, the musicians benefited. And then of course the audience did too, right? They were introduced to all these people that they might not have heard of before. So it was a win-win-win.
Now, I want to talk about what made the Vital Cafe famous most of all, and that was the Dave and Morley stories. And most people that are fans of the show absolutely love Dave Cooks the Turkey. I think we can all agree that's everyone's favorite story. But besides Dave Cooks the Turkey, what's your favorite Dave and Morley story?
For me, there's a whole bunch of different things that I might connect to in a story. So I might love the structure of it, right? Because, of course, a huge part of my job is I might love it because I recognize that it is well crafted or well told. So that's one thing I might like about it. I might love it because the audience really connects to it. I love audiences and I am loyal to them. And I am someone who believes, I am a producer and a performer who believes that audiences are in charge and that you should give them maybe not always exactly what they want, but like that they're your boss, you know, and that they're the ones who, we do this for. And so the ones that the audience connect to are the ones I really love. But I'm going to give you two examples that are not either of those things. So there's two stories that are, I would say, are my favorite, but not for those reasons. They're my favorites because they most accurately capture what I think we tried to do with our show and with those stories. So the first is a story called Christmas at the Turlingtons. And it is it's a barn burner. It's a very funny story. It's a Christmas story. It's about Mary Turlington. So already it's like got a lot going for it. And it's a very, very funny story. And it's also to my point about, you know, well-crafted and structured. Stuart did a great job writing it. Like it's well-told and well-crafted, but it's not my favorite for any of those reasons. It's my favorite because there's one single line at the end of the story, second last line in the story. It's one single sentence that pretty much says it all. It says it in one sentence, he captures what I think we were trying to say with our show, but also how I like to move through life and also how Stuart liked to move through life. So the line is essentially what happens in the story is Mary Turlington her husband invites Dave and Morley and the kids over for Christmas dinner. And, you know, as is so often the case when Dave comes over, things don't go according to plan and it's tumultuous and chaotic and crazy and hilariously funny. And a lot of things go wrong, but it all works out in the end. And at the end of the night, Mary is on the phone to her sister, and she's telling her about everything that went wrong. And Mary's husband, Bert, is cleaning up in the kitchen, and he overhears all of this. And he sees his wife crying, but he also sees her laughing and smiling. And you know, she gives him a hug afterwards, and she tells him about, you know, talking to her sister and everything that her sister said. And Bert kind of wipes a tear off her cheek and says, "Family and friends, they sure mess up our lives." And, you know, it's a tongue in cheek sentence. They do mess up our lives, right? If not for my children and my dog and my husband and my dad, my life would be simpler. It would be easier. Everything would go according to the plan that I make in my head. It would be, smoother, but it would also be, I'm getting choked up talking about it. It would also be meaningless. It would have no texture. It would have less humor. It just wouldn't have layers of meaning. Like it would have some meaning, but it wouldn't have it's family for me anyway. And for Stuart, certainly it's family and friends and the chaos that comes alongside them that make life worth living. And I love that he's able to say that in like seven words or something. It's super powerful. So there's that. And then there's another story called Fish Head, which I love. But again, it's the ending. It's the turn that I really love. In that story, Dave takes his son Sam on a fishing trip. And he tells him some stories about his father who's passed away. And one of the stories he tells him is about when his own father took him on a fishing trip. And they caught this fish, which had an unusual head, and just, he talks about what Dave keeps the fish, and it has a lot of, it has a long, the, you know, the story, and that fish head has a lot of, implications. And the line that I love is where Stuart at the end talks about the fact that there are all these little moments in life that matter. And you never know which of those moments are going to count, right? Like you go off on a fishing trip with your son and you think it's about the fishing trip and it ends up not being about the fishing trip at all. It's not about the trip. It's not even about the fish. It's about the fish head. Like you don't know what's going to count. Like you don't know what kids or, you know, your spouse or your parents or your friends or your neighbor, you don't know which of your actions are going to matter to them and which ones aren't. And so you have to kind of move through life thinking that everything matters and that it's not necessarily the big moments that matter. It's more often the mountain of little tiny micro moments that matter. And that is both, I said this to someone recently, because that's how I live my life. I kind of pay attention to the small little details and I don't make a big deal out of, I kind of make an equal deal out of the big things and the small things. And she was like, well, that must be exhausting. Like, I can't imagine paying attention to all those little things. And I'm like, or freeing, right? Like, because I also don't put overemphasis on, you know, I pay a tremendous amount of attention to like, what, you know, the little things I see when I walk my dog every day, but yet I didn't have a wedding, you know, I didn't have a 40th birthday. I don't put a lot of weight or energy or time or money into these big moments because so often, or for me anyway, I'm often disappointed by those big moments when really there's so much beauty and meaning and kind of, I don't know, it's the micro moments that make up that often bring the beauty, I think. And I don't know, I find that freeing because it's like, those are sort of unexpected and everyday and easy and inexpensive and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I love that story for that reason too, because as I said, both of those stories kind of hit the nail on the head when it comes to what I think Stuart was trying to say with his stories and with the show, which is number one, our life is made up of a mountain of moments and you never know which one's going to count. So you got to make the best of most of it. And number two, that magic's often in the mess. Family and friends mess up our lives. But of course, you wouldn't have it any other way.
And I noticed that you have been releasing some previously unreleased Vinyl Cafe stories, which I think is awesome. But is there a possibility that the work of Stuart McLean could be adapted into other media in the future, such as an animated series or a TV sitcom or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. You know, that's something we toyed with over the years, and it never really took off. But it's not something we're opposed to. It's never really happened and it's never really found its footing. But what do you think? Do you think people would like to see that?
Absolutely. Yes. I think it'd be kind of cool if it was an animated series because I know in the 90s they did a adaptation of Robert Munsch's work on a series called The Bunch of Munch. And I thought it might be kind of cool if we had an animated series that's not geared towards kids, but maybe towards an adult audience that, you know, kids can also enjoy. It'd be like a family show as opposed to being only kids. And because a lot of things that happen to Dave often happen to cartoon characters, I think it would be very fitting too.
You're right. You could easily put a Dave on top of a roof of a car on a bike if it was animated, right? That kind of would be, the laws of physics don't apply in the Vinyl Cafe stories always, right?
That's correct. Or the one where he was on the roof with the big magnet and fell down.
Yeah, phone message.
What sort of things do you do when you're not working on Vinyl Cafe-related material?
I do a bunch of things. I work part-time for the government. So a couple days of work a week, I work for the government, the federal government. I work, I help musicians with their shows. So I kind of will help them figure out how to make their shows more engaging or more fun. I've given some workshops on storytelling to help people learn how to tell their stories. I've built podcasts for people and helped them start their own podcasts. I started my own podcast, as you know, that was Vinyl Cafe related. And I have two little kids. I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. So yeah, I'm busy.
The last show that was recorded, I believe, was in 2015. Could you tell us about that for the listeners that may not be familiar with that special show? Are there any more unreleased Vinyl Cafe stories that we can expect in the near future?
There are. Yeah, there's not tons, but there are some that have never been released on albums. And it's my intention to release all of them. I wasn't sure about that for a long time after Stuart died, but I have a different feeling about that now. I just want to share these with as many people as possible. I want them to be able to enjoy them. So I can't make any promises, Blake, but it's my intention to release all of the stories for sure. The last show was in Thunder Bay, and we, of course, had no idea it would be our last show. We knew it would be the last show of that tour. Stuart had been diagnosed with cancer, and we had made the very difficult decision of ending a tour very early. But we just, at the time, like the success rate for his cancer was something like 85%. We just assumed we'd be back out on the road, you know, the next Christmas for the next Christmas concert. It never occurred to us at the time. So we had no idea that it would be his last show, but it was the last show of that tour. And we had canceled all the tour dates. So it felt big, even though we had no idea how big it actually was going to be. And I ended up recording it just at the last minute, not to do anything with it, but because we assumed that the next Christmas we'd take the same stories and the same musicians, and we try to relaunch that show. So I recorded it almost for archival purposes and for my own, basically for rehearsal purposes, like so that I could play it back to myself and to Stuart and to the musicians, be like, remember when this happened, we did this, and, you know, to help us get back in the game in November, 11 months later. And then, of course, things didn't go according to plan. And, Stuart and I recorded to it. We continued to record after that show. We were in studio. I think we recorded another 26 radio shows in 2016. Like he was fine. He was not that sick for many, many, many months. And we were in studio almost, you know, repeatedly recording these studio shows, but it was our last time on stage. It was the last time Stuart ever stood on stage. And I'm really grateful that I pressed record that day, because it's a wonderful memory for me. And of course, people got to listen to it. CBC aired that show Christmas, the year he died. And it was just a lucky, lucky thing that I decided at the very last minute to press record that day.
That's a beautiful story. And I was introduced to the Vinyl Cafe by my mom and grandma, who used to listen to it all the time. And I was about 8 years old when that happened, and I got hooked. And for me, getting to meet Stuart McLean twice, you know, once when I did the interview with him, and then the first time was in grade 9 when I went to one of his performances, you know, it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we did the interview, I told him, yeah, we did meet before. I asked for your autograph, and he says,
yeah,
looks like you've grown since then.
That's a very Stuart type answer.
Very much so. Noticed on Facebook, as a reference to the birthday cake story, that you gave Stuart a My Little Pony birthday cake, which I thought was just so cool.
Yeah, it was funny. And then not only that, he was kind of, I can't remember exactly what, anyway, long story short, we ended up having a food fight on the bus. And of course I couldn't resist the urge to pull a Mary Turlington and put my hand in the cake from the middle and like smear it all over Stuart's face. So yeah, I have some really fond memories of that particular night. It's a great story. And
for those of you that haven't heard the story, please go to iTunes now or to your favorite audio streaming platform, and please download these stories, because I guarantee you are going to love them. You're going to find them very funny. And Jess, it was fantastic to have you on the show, and thank you so very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. And we look forward to reading and hearing some more unreleased Vinyl Cafe stories.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking the time. It was lovely chatting with you.
And that was Jess Milton, the former producer of The Vinyl Cafe. Be sure to visit vinylcafe.com to find out more about Stuart McLean and to hear some of his stories. Until next time, remember, here at The Medley, we're all kinds of different.